Hello and welcome to ASI Cast number 176. I'm Richard Marks, ASI's Research Director, and joining me today is one of our most regular correspondents across the 9 years we've been podcasting now, which is Guy Bisson, who's Executive Director of Ampere Analysis. Hi, Guy.
Hello, Richard.
So what prompted us to get zooming with Guy for this episode is the publication of a new report that he's co-authored, AI in the TV and film production chain. Now, we know that AI is a hot topic at the moment, but often pieces about AI can be quite speculative and fairly general. What's interesting about this report is that it breaks down how AI is impacting each stage of the TV and film production process, from commissioning through to promotion. We'll also get Guy's perspective on the impact that AI is having on advertising. So, firstly, Guy, let's define terms. In the report, you're keen to differentiate between two very specific but different types of AI.
Yeah, that's right. So in the report, we talk about two types of AI. Really, they're two sides of the same coin because they rely on the same technology. The AI that most people talk about today, and you'll often see referred to, is generative AI. And what that means is that the AI is creating new stuff, new content, by analyzing the relationship between information. So very, very deep connections between microcosms of different parts of information, often words, in so-called large language modules, so that you can then rebuild from the component parts something new. The other side of the coin, and as I say, the technology is very similar, if not the same, is discriminative AI. It works in the same way in respect that it's all about finding the relationship between elements that make up information and mapping that relationship. But instead of creating new information, it takes new information as an input and relates it to the large amount of information it already has. And therefore, it generates an answer from that information that is factually correct. One of the issues, of course, with generative AI, in a way, it's like the friend who will never admit that they don't know something. So if you ask it to generate something, in about 20% of cases, it will make something up completely that is not correct, because it's generated an answer that sounds perfectly logical, makes perfect sense, but is completely incorrect. Discriminative AI will not do that because it's flipped the relationship in a way. It uses the information, takes the new and relates it to the old, and says, this is most like this, therefore we can draw these conclusions. So they have different uses. Obviously, generative is more for the creative side of the film and TV production chain. Discriminative is more for the analytical side of the TV creation chain.
And also potentially close to home for us in the area of data and measurement and analysis and all that that related area to video measurement, I guess. What you were talking about with generative AI, I think it's sometimes referred to politely as hallucination, isn't it? When they're making something up, or is that a different phenomenon?
No, I've not heard that term myself, but it's a good way to describe it. I think it's important to understand that with generative, and that applies, obviously we think of it maybe because we've probably all used ChatGPT and similar. We think of it in terms of words and the answers that the AI is giving us. But it's also, of course, applies to video and the creation of video. And also from ChatGPT, the video text to video creation tool Sora, which is not publicly available yet, but will be. They themselves have highlighted some of the amusing mistakes that it can make, for these very reasons, that it interprets in a certain way and it makes things up that logically kind of make sense, but don't actually work. And one of the things when you're creating, of course, especially with video, is and movie and TV production is you need continuity and consistency. And when you're generating on the fly constantly, that becomes increasingly difficult. So there are issues and problems with the use of AI at every stage of the chain. And it's just important to be aware of some of the limitations.
You also highlight another important difference, which is between open and closed AI. So what are the different applications of those two types of AI?
Again, it's nothing spectacularly sort of new there. It's about who controls or where. So think of it in terms of what we're all familiar with: open source code and closed. So a company, a commercial entity, controls one, and the other is open source. Anyone can access the code. Anyone can contribute to its development. And really, OpenAI, of course, as the name suggests, is open, although Microsoft is a major financial contributor to OpenAI. Some of the other systems, particularly aspects of Google's AI, for example, are more closed. And it affects all sorts of things. It affects the speed of development of these tools. And generally, the open approach, it seems to be proving better in respect of the speed of development within this area. And it is an incredibly fast-moving area. Literally, every week, there's almost another milestone, it seems.
At each stage of the process, in terms of producing content from commissioning through to scripting, through to editing, through to shooting, through to even promotion of the film, I was struck by the fact that at each stage the report was listing at least a half a dozen products at each stage that seemed to be already there or in development aimed at that specific task. But if you boil it down, who really are the major players when it comes specifically to the AI that's going to be assisting TV and film?
Yeah, it's a really good question and a really important point, because a lot of the tools and many of these tools, and I think it's also important to say many of these tools are almost free or extremely low cost to access and use. Many of them are actually reskinned Chat GPT or similar, so existing large language modules that have a wrapper put around them. And then guidance is given to that model to point it in a certain direction and give it a certain character. So there's a technique called pre-prompting, where you can effectively prompt one of these existing models to behave in a certain way. And for example, that could create different personalities in terms of its response to you. So the major players, frankly, behind many of the tools, indirectly often, so they're not behind them in terms of their branding, but the technology they've built is behind them, are the usual suspects. ChatGPT is one, Google is another, Twitter or X is behind another of the large language modules out there, although that's a little more of a closed system. In respect that you have to be a customer to access. I mean, you have to be a premium customer of X to access that tool. But
Is that is
Apple,
is that what's
sorry,
called Rock? I think it's called
Grok,
Rock.
yeah.
Isn't it?
So Grok was created as a protest almost at ChatGPT, when because Elon Musk was heavily involved in the early stages of that system, objected to some of the direction they were taken and built his own large language module that was deliberately supposed to be a bit tongue in cheek. So it's a bit more it's a bit more reactive in terms of the way it will speak to you. It actually highlights another really important point of AI within the creative space. And it's one that you wouldn't really think of. But because safeguards have been put in place for the large language modules that we're all using, and those are often very necessary safeguards. So they might be safeguards around sexism, racism, around the use of foul language, for example. Those restrictions have been put in place on those large language modules. But if you're writing a screenplay about a serial killer or, a civil rights protest or other aspects of history that might be contentious, then that tool becomes less useful in terms of that creative process. So there is a whole discussion around, I guess, what you could call censorship or restrictions of these tools, which actually, when we come to use them for the creative process, hinder that process because of the safeguards that have been put in place. So there are other large language modules that don't have those controls in place.
I think a good example of that recently was famously the when the Google AI was serving up pictures of Nazi stormtroopers of Afro-Caribbean descent because it thought it was being politically correct. I guess that's the trouble, because on the one hand, AI is trained on all of us, and all of us includes periods in history when that there have been issues around representation, which is hard to kind of, I guess, teach AI to understand that sort of thing. But in terms of the way in which it's being used, you mentioned that a lot of it is being built out of or skinned on ChatGPT, but also that a lot of the software that's out there is free or nearly free. Presumably, that is just a gateway drug to get people using it before the costs are ramped up. Or does money not matter in the world of AI? Certainly, I read somewhere a couple of days ago that ChatGPT is losing fortunes at the moment. But presumably, that's like the model, as we've discussed in the past about subscription VOD, is about reach at the moment, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it's about reach. I think, but everything has to make money at the end of the day. And I read the same article. I think it was 500 million loss in a quarter for half a billion for ChatGPT, if I remember rightly. Yeah, obviously, ultimately, every company needs to make money. And we know the model in the tech space has traditionally been build the user base, then worry about monetization. And ChatGPT does have ways of monetizing through pay per query when you start using it in a professional capacity. I think that at the moment, it's clearly everyone is talking about AI. Probably everyone who's going to listen to this podcast has used ChatGPT and possibly Google Gemini and others. But in terms of using it seriously in high capacity, that's still emerging and developing. And when that becomes more the norm, then the monetization will follow. I just think it's so easy to forget, again, with many things that we talk about, you and I, even on this podcast, how early stage we are in the journey towards AI and its integration into day-to-day life and business. We're barely 2 years in to the release of these large language models. And already the impact they're making is massive. But once they scale, once they become fully integrated into companies and businesses' processes, then the monetization is definitely there.
Isn't that the danger, though, that they become integrated into companies because they can see the cost savings? And I know there's a lot of talk about AI is sort of enhancing people's careers because it's giving them additional skills. But it must be hard to know how, if a lot of this stuff is effectively being subsidized and will be costing more in the future, it must be hard to know where the end game is. I mean, a specific example, we were at an RTS, a Royal Television Society meeting a few months ago, and they were talking about editing software, which you refer to in the report, which could take hundreds of hours of reality TV footage from seven different cameras and actually be taught to make sense of it, edit it together, and then someone would come in and look at the footage and tweak it or so on. So you know, presumably the production company thinks, great, I can save on film editors, but they're not going to know how much they can save because at the moment, presumably that is a pretty much a subsidized product.
Yeah, I'm not sure that it's a subsidized per se. I think what I'm saying is that it's simply as the use of a technology scales, the monetization follows because the pathway and the fee structure is already there. And clearly some companies and people are using it at capacity, but we're only just at the beginning of that usage. And once the capacity comes up, the money comes up even without necessarily increasing the costs. It's just the volume follows and allows the monetization to follow. And that's the point I was making about being at that early stage. The pricing is not is there. It's not hidden or non-transparent. Clearly, the costs could go up in the future, but I think it's more the usage and the volume throughput that will go up and generate the revenue for these tools and these companies.
Let's have a focus briefly on advertising specifically. We've been talking mainly in the report about content itself, but there's a lot of talk around AI, obviously, in the advertising area. Is that a field that you'd say is more or less advanced in its use of AI, given that we're talking shorter treatments, we're talking versioning, etc.? Is in some ways advertising likely to be ahead of actual long form video content in terms of its use of AI, do you think?
I think the potential is definitely there for it to, in some ways, lead the way in terms of the use of AI in both, well, many aspects, targeting, of course. And so many of the tools that we do talk about in the report that may be used, for example, for analyzing scripts, predicting audience emotion and reaction to plot points. And characterization and story arcs can also be used in targeting advertising, but also then in terms of creation of dynamic advertising, dynamic creative. So creating very targeted adverts on the fly effectively through to follow through from the targeting analysis that the AI tool is able to do. And then we've got other aspects of brand replacement. So again, some of the tools we talk about, and you mentioned editing software, but the ability to replace objects in real time within the video stream. And that object, of course, can be a product. A product that is placed either within the advert, of course, but can also be used in longer form content in terms of product placement. So you could dynamically change the products in a drama, for example, dependent on the country that you were showing the episode in, or the language that you were showing the episode in. And all of this can be done in real time. The tech is not especially new because it can be done manually, but the AI is able to do it much quicker and much more accurately than a human being would be able to do using more traditional techniques. And this opens up all sorts of opportunity through the chain from targeting to creation to actually product placement and other forms of advertising within drama and movies.
It's I was at an event a while back where a company who does ad pre-testing was talking, and someone asked them, "Have you tested any AI ads?" And it turned out they had tested quite a few AI generated ads, and they said that they actually tested at the exact average of all ads. So they weren't bad, they weren't good, they were the exact average, which I guess talks to the point about what generative AI is, which is a summation of everything it's learned.
Yeah, and again, a very important point. And I think if you speak to anyone in any aspect of the creative chain, whether that be script writers, directors, producers, that they would make that very same point, that you can it's a tool. It takes you so far, but it's never going to create the next breakout, off the wall masterpiece, because it's simply not capable of true creative thought. And even using the term thought, it gets us into the sort of realms of sci-fi, because of course we call it artificial intelligence, but one could argue that it's not actually very intelligent. It's all about data relationships. It's about creating those very fine connections between information, and then using those connections to recreate something. So, by definition, in a way, it cannot come up with something truly revolutionary. And that's why when you're using it, so I made my own videos to demonstrate some of the tools, where I asked an AI to create me 10 episodes of a TV drama, or treatments for 10 episodes of a TV drama set in Chicago in the 1920s, focused on the jazz scene. And it came up with 10 pretty good episode summaries. But to turn that into something that would really sell and really engage the audience, you still need that human creativity.
I guess the other elephant in the room, which the report does go into, is the legal, ethical, and moral considerations of AI. I was talking to a colleague a couple of days ago. I mentioned I was going to be doing this podcast, and he said that he'd been talking to people who were saying that artificial intelligence was the wrong name. But actually, it should be called collective intelligence because it's a summation of the knowledge that's out there. But obviously, that knowledge has been created by people who are very concerned about the copyright at the moment. Is that, do you think that is going to be a major issue, or is it something that's going to be almost impossible to police?
Yeah, it's another really important and interesting question. And disclaimer, obviously, I'm not a lawyer, and I'm not trained in copyright law. My personal take on it is that it's not that different from where we were before AI existed. So there used to be a sort of comical adage that said, if you use one source, that is plagiarism. If you use 10 sources, that is research. And in a way, AI is doing exactly that. It is taking multiple sources. That's what it's trained on. And then using that information, but to create something new, which is what I guess a researcher did for a newspaper, or a journalist did when they were researching, say, a story. It's just that AI does it on a much larger scale, and does it very quickly and efficiently. So to me, there's not a huge difference in that. And we have seen an increase in companies that own intellectual property monetizing that through an official deal, saying you can train on my information, but you must pay me a fee, and other companies saying you must not train on my information, And closing the door to the large language module from using that for training. So we're in this funny stage where some people are embracing it and saying, okay, let's do a deal. Others are closing the door. At the end of the day, though, it is creating new content, albeit derived from thousands and thousands of relationships between existing content. And that's where I think the legal aspect gets a little confused, and gets a little challenging to conclude who is right and who is wrong, or what is right and what is wrong.
Well, presumably, even whether something was used in the first place.
Yes, so there was a case with the New York Times where they said that the AI was creating almost verbatim content from their newspaper. The pushback from OpenAI was that they had paid someone to prompt it so precisely that it almost had no choice but to recreate the IP that was owned by the New York Times. So again, it comes back to that volume question. If you keep drilling and keep drilling and keep drilling very, very precisely and prompting, you can get to one of the starting points. And I've actually found this myself. And you can test this yourself. If like me, you have very obscure interests and hobbies, and you've probably read everything there is out there on the internet about it. And often there's only one or two sources of information on the entire internet. And if you ask an AI about that, it will come back pretty much with the one source that you've already read. Can you recognize it? You recognize the phrasing and the wording. So there's definitely an aspect of copyright that needs to be further investigated, but it only becomes visible when you've drilled down to the nth degree. And in normal usage, I would argue, again, not from a lawyer's perspective, that it's not different from how we have always operated in terms of using multiple sources, researching from multiple sources, pulling it together to create something that is different and new.
Well, you're almost getting into the arguments that have been around for centuries about, nature versus nurture, and is there really such a thing as a totally creative idea, or is every idea shaped by the lived experience of the person who's having the idea, I guess. It's gonna be really tricky to legislate on, I think, but certainly there is incoming legislation. I know that last week, I think Elon Musk was claiming that Europe was going to trail the US because of imminent EU legislation, but we'll have to see whether that's the case or whether it actually means the EU will be safer due to such legislation. But I know it's a topic we could fill quite a few podcasts with, but that sounds like a good point to end our discussions today. You can download the report we've been talking about from the MIP site, and we'll put a link in that to that in the show notes. But in the meantime, thanks for sharing your non-artificial original ideas with us today, Guy.
Thank you.